Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next 2 half-hour segments, we're going to be presenting some material, much of which will be familiar to veteran and regular listeners. However, it is going to be presented in a context which hopefully will help to connect the dots. In fact, that's what the next 2 half-hour segments are entitled, Connecting the Dots, because what I'm hoping to do is to tie in a number of seemingly disparate areas of inquiry that have been accessed on this program over the years. We're going to plunge right in, and we're going to begin by reprising some information from a couple of half-hour segments entitled The Tides of 20th Century Capital Flow that were recorded not too long ago as I speak in mid-July of 1998. We're going to turn once again to the book The Splendid Blonde Beast, subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century. This book was authored by Christopher Simpson, the author of, among other titles, Blowback and The Science of Coercion, both of which I've accessed at considerable length on this program before. And Chris Simpson's The Splendid Blonde Beast was published in softcover by the Common Courage Press of Monroe, Maine. Copyright 1995. The first name that we're going to look at here is that of Dillon and Reed. Dillon Reed is a major Wall Street investment firm, and as we looked at in not only the Uncle Sam and the Swastika Archive program, but also the aforementioned pair of half-hour segments entitled The Tides of 20th Century Capital Flow, Dillon Reed was an essential element of the Wall Street elite, which along with the corresponding Riga faction of the State Department had much to do with capitalizing Germany in the 1920s and 1930s. That capital in turn not only built up Nazi war-making industry, but also was instrumental in promoting the vast corporate interests that helped to promote Adolf Hitler to power. And again, the full discussion of that in the 2 half-hour segments, The Tides of 20th Century Capital Flow, as well as the aforementioned Uncle Sam and the Swastika program. Now, note here Dillon Reed's role in helping to finance German industry in the 1920s in order to help build up Germany as a bulwark against communism. Note also that one of the major beneficiaries of Dillon Reed's activities was the Fleck Empire. Friedrich Fleck was one of the top industrialists who backed Hitler, was convicted as a war criminal. After the war, became a principal stockholder, the dominant stockholder in Daimler-Benz, which, as we saw recently, purchased Chrysler. Daimler-Benz purchase of Chrysler is covered in a couple of half-hour segments entitled German Corporate Acquisitions in the United States. Of Dillon Reed and its role in capitalizing Germany in the 1920s and 30s, Christopher Simpson writes as follows. Dillon Reed and Company, private U.S. investment bankers, specialized in loans to Deutsche Bank, Siemens, and Fleck interests. Between 1925 and the stock market crash in 1929, these loans amounted to more than $250 million. Friedrich Fleck built his fortune during the 1920s using bonds sold by Dillon Reed to finance what today might be called leverage buyouts of German and Polish coal and steel companies. So again, note the role of Dillon Reed in recapitalizing Germany in the 20s and 30s, and note also one of the major recipients of Dillon Reed largesse, namely the Fleck Corporation, the Fleck interests of Friedrich Fleck. As we're going to see, or as we saw, I should say, in the 2 half-hour segments entitled Tides of 20th Century Capital Flow, as well as in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, one of the principal figures from Dillon Reed, William H. Draper, Jr., of the Draper textile family, a very prominent and reactionary New England textile family. We're going to take a look at the Draper family and another member of that family, Wycliffe Draper, later on in our second half-hour segment. But Brigadier General William Draper of Dillon Reed was put in charge of the economic section of the U.S. occupation government, basically the Allied Control Council of Germany, and as the top American officer in charge with overseeing the economic reconstruction of Germany, William H. Draper was instrumental in seeing to it that the same German industrial and financial elite that had supported Hitler was put right back in power. And recall, as we looked at in Uncle Sam and the Swastika and the two half-hour segments about 20th century capital flow, those industrialists on the German end constituted the German end of a transatlantic financial and industrial axis, and as we'll see later on in these two segments, that axis was also an ideological and intellectual axis as well. Of Brigadier General William Draper, his role with Dillon Reed, and his role with the Allied Control Council for Germany, Christopher Simpson writes as follows in The Splendid Blonde Beast. Dillon Reed and company partner William Draper became pivotal to the semi-clandestine shift in U.S. policy toward Germany that summer. By the way, that summer is 1945. Continuing, by 1945, Secretary of War Stimson and Secretary of the Navy Forrestal, Dillon Reed's former president, engineered Draper's appointment as chief of the economic division of the Joint Allied Control Council for Germany, the central occupation government at the time, and as director of economic policy for the German territories administered by the U.S. As such, Draper emerged as by far the most powerful U.S. industrial and finance official in occupied Germany, with overall authority for implementing Joint Chiefs of Staff 1067 and other U.S. denazification programs aimed at German bankers and businessmen. Skipping down. Prior to the war, he had been corporate treasurer for Dillon Reed and an officer of the German Credit and Investment Corporation of New Jersey, a Dillon Reed-sponsored holding company that specialized in international investments in Hitler-era Germany. He prided himself on his willingness to make tough, even brutal decisions to protect his vision of the common good. And note this next passage here, because it deals with the Draper family, their textile empire, and in particular the austerely run, I would say authoritarian-style, company towns that the Drapers ran. We're going to hear reference to this in our second half-hour segment. The Draper family owned textile mills, patents on textile equipment, and a substantial share of the international trade in fibers. Their New England mill towns featured model workers' communities, unquote, where the company enforced a Draper family formula of no unions, proper sanitation, and good behavior. And bear in mind the Draper family's company towns. We're going to touch on those later in connection with another key member of the Draper family, Wycliffe Draper, a prominent American eugenicist and associate, actually prime financial backer of the Pioneer Fund. Bear in mind that as a result of the activities of people like William Draper at the American end of this transatlantic financial and industrial and ideological axis that I've spoken about, the very same German industrial and corporate elite that had supported Hitler was put right back in power. One of those was Friedrich Fleck, whose empire was largely built up as the result of Dillon Reed largesse, as we have seen. Research credit on the following goes to Dave White. This is an article that I read into the record in the two half-hour segments entitled German Corporate Acquisitions in the United States that you heard alluded to earlier. The following comes from The Guardian of Wednesday, March 13th of 1996. This is an article by Tom Bauer entitled Shame Behind the Name, and it's about Friedrich Fleck. By the way, in the two half-hour segments about 20th century capital flow, I misspoke myself. The Fleck family still has significant capital participation in Daimler-Benz, which just acquired Chrysler, but Friedrich Fleck himself died in 1972. I misspoke myself and said Friedrich Fleck, not the Fleck family. Of Friedrich Fleck, Tom Bauer writes as follows in The Guardian of 3/13/96. In 1947, Fleck was convicted as a war criminal at Nuremberg for his use of slave labor and sentenced to 7 years imprisonment. After his premature release in 1951, he sought to sanitize his past and remove the family's brown stain. By the time of his death, Friedrich, who had never lost respectability among his German peers, owned nearly 50% of Daimler-Benz, worth more than $1 billion. Much of that fortune passed to his two grandsons, and ever since the mid-80s, they have been welcomed as residents in London by estate agents and other traders. Still more about the post-war activities of Friedrich Fleck, who cashed in his exhausted mines and factories for the controlling interest in Daimler-Benz. Skipping down in the article, in 1948, when the old Reichsmark currency was replaced by the Deutsche Mark, revaluing Fleck's solid assets, swollen by his wartime plunder and profiteering, Hermann Abs, that's Hermann Abs of the Deutsche Bank, one of Hitler's top bankers, Abs negotiated with the government to swap Fleck's exhausted coal mines and factories for Daimler-Benz. A good deal, Abs proudly claimed in 1979, reminiscing about Fleck's fortunate early release at the outbreak of the Korean War, and his client's appointment of Nazi cronies to Daimler-Benz's new board of management. Bear in mind that the Fleck Empire, the beneficiaries of Dillon Reed largesse. Turning back once again to The Splendid Blonde Beast by Christopher Simpson, I'm going to reprise another element from the two half-hour segments about 20th century capital flow concerning the German industrialists and financiers who constituted the German end of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that is instrumental in the promotion of and arming of fascism, both militarily and ideologically, on both sides of the Atlantic in the 20th century. Christopher Simpson writes of the corporatist philosophy of empire that was espoused espoused by the key German industrialists and financiers behind Hitler, in contrast to the SS vision of a self-sufficient Nazi empire in Central and Eastern Europe. These corporatists favored using German arms to conquer countries and then restructuring the corporate economies of those countries in such a way as to permit the dominance of those economies by German-based cartels, and then those German-based cartels would then re-enter world markets. So the combination of German arms and German capital would work in conjunction, according to these two, and the German companies would benefit from the German conquest by arms, and those countries' economies would then be dominated by German-based cartels. In the two half-hour segments about 20th century capital flow, we took a look at the second major capital flow, namely the capital flow from the coffers of the occupied nations of Europe into the coffers of the Third Reich. This was the realization of the corporatist strategy for empire espoused by these industrialists. Reprising this information from The Splendid Blonde Beast, we read, "In contrast, much of the banking and industrial elite of Germany favored a more traditional, imperial approach to acquiring a new empire in Europe. Among their principal spokesmen were Economics Minister Hjalmar Schacht, Hermann Abs, in parentheses, whom we just heard about, and a young Reichsbank director, Carl Blessing. Their strategy favored integrating businesses in countries occupied by the Germans into private industrial syndicates coordinated through German-based cartels and through private institutions such as Deutsche Bank. The private companies, in turn, pledged their loyalty to Hitler's government. German military conquest should be used to create conditions through which German corporations could buy up the key enterprises in newly subjugated countries at very favorable prices, this faction contended, but only in rare instances should the state take direct command of industry. Much of the senior leadership of the Deutsche Bank, IG Farben, the Siemens Group of Companies, and other German-based cartels maintained that Germany should re-enter the world marketplace rather than attempt to build up the orthodox Nazi dream of a self-sufficient German empire in Central and Eastern Europe." And reprising yet another segment of The Splendid Blonde Beast that we looked at in the tides of 20th century capital flow, these corporatists dominated the German industrial and financial elite that supported Hitler, the German end of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, and as we shall see, they were inextricably linked, or I should say heavily involved with the SS, through the Himmlerkreis, or Himmler Circle of Friends. We looked at this in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, and the Uncle Sam and the Swastika archive show the Himmler Circle of Friends was a group of industrialists and financiers who supported the SS and financed the SS's daily operations. In exchange, they got the pick of the SS slave labor pool, and they worked very closely with the SS and coordinated their policies with them. Now note, as the Third Reich's fortunes began to decline, these corporatists, working in conjunction with the SS-connected industrialists of the Himmlerkreis, were the point element that was preparing contingency plans for Nazi defeat. And as such, these were the main elements working with people like William Draper in the war's wake, and they were the German end of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, and thanks to the efforts of their American counterparts, were put right back in power after World War II. Turning once again to The Splendid Blonde Beast, we read of these corporatists connected with the Himmlerkreis and the SS. The notorious Himmlerkreis, the Circle of Friends of Reichsfuhrer SS Heinrich Himmler, is a good example of the dynamics of Germany's high-level business networks during the decline of the Third Reich. The Nazis and leading German businessmen had jointly created the Himmlerkreis in the early 1930s as an informal communication link between the financial and industrial elite and the SS. Himmler sought the political and economic support of the business elite, and the elite in turn sought influence outside of official channels with the increasingly powerful police leader. Senior business leaders active in the Himmlerkreis included Siemens General Director Rudolf Bingel, Unilever and Continental Oil Director Carl Blessing, Steel industrialist Friedrich Fleck, by the way, whom we just heard about, who was the beneficiary of Dylan Reed's efforts, continuing, Dresdner Bank's Karl Rasche and Emil Meyer, shipping and oil executive Karl Lindemann, and board members or senior managers from the Deutsche Bank, RKG, IG Farben, Krupp, and a dozen other companies central to the German economy. As the SS grew as an economic power, the SS members of the Himmlerkreis often migrated to new positions on corporate boards, where they could secure government contracts and embody corporate loyalty to the regime. SS men and Nazi Party activists who made this transition included Wilhelm Kepler of the Braybag Brown Coal Combine and SS Enterprises, Fritz Kronefuss of Braybag, Dresdner Bank, and Ritter von Halt, who joined the Deutsche Bank board. Officially, the Himmlerkreis meetings were not for conducting business because that would have suggested corruption in National Socialist circles. As a practical matter, however, the encounters served as an informal coordinating point for German industry's negotiations with the SS on policy matters. I.G. Farben appears to have used Himmlerkreis meetings to seek support for the company's vast forced labor complex at Auschwitz, for example. The companies represented in Himmler's circle became pacesetters in Aryanization, exploitation of concentration camp labor, seizure of foreign companies in the occupied territories, and similar business ventures that depended on SS cooperation. But as the war turned against the Third Reich, a number of business leaders in the Himmlerkreis began to cooperate in clandestine and semi-clandestine contingency planning for the post-war period. Two of the best known of these groups, the Working Group for Foreign Economic Questions and the Kleine Arbeitskreis, or Small Working Group, were nominally sponsored by the Reichsgruppe Industry Association of Major Industrial and Financial Companies. Christopher Simpson then goes on to name a number of the key players in this Himmlerkreis-connected group of industrialists and financiers, again part of the corporatist faction that we heard about just a few minutes ago. And as we shall see, this group is instrumental in working with the American end of the transatlantic financial and industrial axis to retain the position of the German industrial and financial elite at the end of World War II. Note in particular the name of Ludwig Erhard. He was Konrad Adenauer's economics minister, the chief architect of German economic reconstruction at the end of World War II, and later became Chancellor of Germany, and he's one of the key SS-connected industrialists that we're about to hear about. Returning once again to the splendid Blonde Beast fight by Simpson, of this group we read, "They brought together Blessing, Rasche, Kurt von Schroeder, Lindemann, and others from the Himmlerkreis, with other business people such as Hermann Obbs of the Deutsche Bank, Ludwig Erhard, then an economist with the Reichsgruppe Industry and later Konrad Adenauer's most important economic advisor, Ludger Westrich of RKG Aluminum Industry and Non-Ferrous Metals, Philip Rienstra of Tobacco, Shipping and Banking, and with Nazi business specialists such as Otto Ohlendorf, the former commander of the Einsatzgruppe D murder troops, and Hans Kerl, the SS business specialist. A half dozen similar business forums emerged during the last years of the Third Reich. Most of these overlapped in membership, and all of them favored some variation of the corporatist strategy for empire articulated by Hjalmar Schacht, Obbs, and others during the showdown over Aryanization in Vienna discussed earlier." Now, bear in mind that this group, the key players in the German end of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, favored the corporatist strategy for empire that we looked at earlier, because as we saw in the tides of 20th century capital flow, and as we're about to review, that corporatist strategy for empire was realized in the post-World War II period as well, when the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization came into being. This is an organization I've talked about in the past. As the Third Reich's fortunes were declining, and as the Third Reich was making preparations for defeat, Martin Bormann, the genius who was Hitler's most important aide, and he was an organizational genius and arguably the most important figure of the Third Reich, and the man who succeeded Hitler as the de facto leader of the Underground Reich, Heinrich Himmler put together a series of 750 corporate fronts, and acting in conjunction with the major German corporations, these corporate fronts were set up primarily as holding companies, and the third major capital flow that we looked at consisted of the flow of capital from the coffers of the Third Reich that had swollen from the second major capital flow from the coffers of the occupied nations of Europe. Money flowed from the coffers of corporate Germany and the treasury of the Third Reich into these 750 Bormann corporate fronts, a perpetuation of the corporatist strategy for empire that we just looked at. We're going to turn once again to the definitive book about the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. That book is called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. It was authored by Paul Manning and published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, copyright 1981. By the way, Manning covered World War II in Europe for CBS News along with Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite, and he's a very, very respected journalist. Of these 750 corporate fronts that served as the repositories for the Bormann Flight Capital, we read, 750 new corporations were established in the last months of the war under the direction of Reichsleiter Bormann using the technique perfected by Hermann Schmitz. Hermann Schmitz, by the way, a key official with the IG Farben Chemical Company. continuing. A national of each country was the nominal head of each corporate structure, and the board was a mix of German administrators and bank officials, while the staffing at senior and middle management levels was comprised of German scientists and technicians. In the background were the shadowy owners of the corporation, those Germans who possessed the bearer bonds as proof of stock ownership. The establishment of such companies, usually launched in industries requiring high technical skills, was welcomed in Spain and Argentina, to give two examples, because those governments appreciated that German companies would generate jobs and implement a more favorable balance of trade. Country by country, a breakdown by U.S. Treasury investigators of these new 750 German firms was as follows. Portugal, 58, Spain, 112, Sweden, 233, Switzerland, 214, Turkey, 35, and Argentina, 98. And note that the countries, the neutral countries that were the beneficiaries or in which these countries were located, were very welcome, very much welcomed the business that came their way because obviously it boosted their economies. We're going to review another section from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and this highlights the profound relationship between the Bormann flight capital companies and contemporary corporate Germany, or at least contemporary as of the late 70s and early 80s. Bear in mind that this book was published in 1981. Returning to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. As for Martin Bormann, this now elderly recluse is ever a keen watcher and manipulator in the silent, gigantic struggles among worldwide industrial and financial powers. Atop an organizational pyramid that dominates the industry of West Germany through banks, voting rights enjoyed by majority shareholders in significant cartels, and the professional input of a relatively young leadership group of lawyers, investment specialists, bankers, and industrialists, he is satisfied that he achieved his aim of helping the fatherland back on its feet. To ensure continuity of purpose and direction, a close watch is maintained on the profit statements and management reports of corporations under its control elsewhere. This leadership group of 20, which is in fact a board of directors, is chaired by Bormann, but power is shifted to the younger men who will carry on the initiative that grew from that historic meeting in Strasbourg on August 10, 1944. Old Heinrich Müller, chief of security for the NSDAP in South America and the former Gestapo chief, I would add, continuing, is the most feared of all, having the power of life and death over those deemed not to be acting in the best interests of the organization. Skipping down. What will not pass is the economic influences of the Bormann organization, whose commercial directives are obeyed almost without question by the highest echelons of West German finance and industry. Quote, all orders come from the shareholders in South America, unquote, I have been told by a spokesman for Martin Bormann. And as I've stated in the past, I think ultimately the Bormann organization is going to prove to be the dominant element in human affairs on this planet in this century. Now, again, what we're doing here is connecting the dots. I'm presenting information that will be familiar to veteran and regular listeners. And we're going to turn once again to the book Serpent's Walk by Randolph D. Calverhall. This is a Nazi tract put out by National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the National Alliance, arguably the most important and dangerous of the domestic Nazi groups. By the way, this is the same publishing outfit that puts out the book The Turner Diaries that was the model for the Nazi group The Order that we'll hear about in our next segment, and that was also purportedly the blueprint and role model for Timothy McVeigh and the bombers of Oklahoma City. This book is about a takeover by the SS of the United States in the mid-21st century. The book was published in softcover by National Vanguard Books and is copyrighted 1991. I'm going to very quickly read the back flap. And by the way, Serpent's Walk is analyzed and reviewed in a half-hour segment that is available from Spitfire. Reading the back flap of Serpent's Walk, and this also is by way of review, the good guys win sometimes. Not always, of course. They lost big in the Second World War. That war was a victory for communists, Democrats, and Jews, but everyone else lost, including millions of GIs who were told that they were killing Germans and Japanese in order to make the world a decent place for their children to grow up, only to see things in America go from bad to much, much worse in the decades after the war. Even when the bad guys win, they sometimes grow careless and later become losers. Look what happened to the communists of Eastern Europe in the 1990s. Could the same thing happen to their erstwhile World War II allies in America? Serpent's Walk explores that possibility. It assumes that Hitler's warrior elite, the SS, didn't give up their struggle for a white world when they lost the Second World War. Instead, their survivors went underground and adopted some of the tactics of their enemies. They began building their economic muscle and buying into the opinion-forming media. And by the way, bear in mind the Borman Flight Capital Organization that we talked about earlier. Continuing, a century after the war, they are ready to challenge the Democrats and Jews for the hearts and minds of white Americans who have begun to have their fill of government-enforced multiculturalism and, quote, equality, unquote. And what we're going to do is to review a passage from Serpent's Walk that we've looked at before. This is a conversation between a member of this SS underground called Wrench and a fellow named Lessing, who is a mercenary who's guarding one of these SS post-World War II corporate properties. He later becomes a convert to the Nazi cause. And this is Wrench telling Lessing about this Flight Capital program. In 1945, when Germany lost, two submarines arrived in Argentina. Some of the remaining senior officers of the SS were aboard. They brought money, lots of money, a good part of the treasury of the Third Reich. People thought it was lost or stolen down in Bavaria, but it wasn't. Skipping down. It wasn't only Bormann. There were others. Seeing Lessing's look, Wrench hurried on. Quote, they found that a colony, set up businesses, made connections. Later they invested, linked up, developed. They built a series of interlocking corporations. The post-war boom and the recovery of Germany helped those corporations become conglomerates, then huge international holding companies based in the goddamnedest places. Skipping down. Yes, everything neat and tidy, out of sight, away from the Jews and the Nazi hunters and their network of financial institutions and pressure groups. The Third World made it easier. There are fewer controls here, fewer restrictions, fewer checks, fewer regulations, fewer watchdog agencies, less hassle with privacy. You can spot outsiders coming, like that coal bird in the mango tree over there. He can see all around his nest. They, the SS, and their descendants, made friends in local governments. The Third Worlders needed know-how, money, connections, and expertise. And skipping down. The SS, what was left of it, had business objectives before and during World War II. When the war was lost, they just kept on, but from other places. Bogota, Asunción, Buenos Aires, Rio de Janeiro, Mexico City, Colombo, Damascus, Dakar, you name it. They realize that the world is heading toward a corporocracy, 5 or 10 international super companies that will run everything worth running by the year 2100. Those super corporations exist now, and they're already dividing up the production and marketing of food, transport, steel and heavy industry, oil, the media, and other commodities. They're mostly conglomerates with fingers in more than one pie. And skipping down again, we, the SS, have the say in 4 or 5. We've been competing for the past 60 years or so, and we're slowly gaining. And again, in the book Serpent's Walk, this SS corporate empire, post-World War II corporate empire, obviously a description of the remarkable and deadly Borman Flight Capital Organization, which is a reality, they eventually buy into and control the American media and take over the United States in this particular book. And again, in the book Serpent's Walk, in my analysis of the book Serpent's Walk, I've stated that I think this is far more than the novel it purports to be. I think it's a blueprint for what is going on and what is planned for the future. Note in particular in the passage I just read you that the Third World countries in which these corporations were set up welcomed this Nazi capital because it obviously improved the economic situation of those countries. That's similar to what we saw in the passage from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, that we looked at earlier. We're going to touch on Serpent's Walk once again in the second half-hour segment. That's coming up soon. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.